Wait, you're starting already?
Yep.
Okay. Hello. It's been about a month and a half since we put out a podcast. Oh wait, a month.
Yeah, about a month.
Okay. So sorry to all of you who have been waiting patiently, all five of you. And but I waiting. Know who you are.
Yeah. Hi, Dustin. Hi, Ross.
Hi, a few people in the department.
Yeah.
We've got a great radius for this thing. We've got a couple people across the way in the other part of the building. A few people in your cohort, and then Bowling Green University.
That's right.
It's not true. We've got people from around the world that listen to us ramble on about indigenous issues, sovereignty, decolonization, ethnic studies, and so on. But so for those of you who have forgotten what we're called, this is Voicing Indigeneity Podcast. My name is Miguet.
I'm Angie.
And then Madel finished her qualifying exam questions for our department, and so she is right now in Las Vegas gambling away all her money and energy.
I wish it was me.
No, she's not actually in Las Vegas. I lied. She's visiting family up north. So me and Angie will be doing it as the dynamic duo this time instead of the terrific trio that we usually are.
That's true. I did invite someone from my cohort. He's our only guy, Long Bui, and he's interested in these topics. Gosh, that sounds so unsexy. But he, you know, I've been talking about sovereignty and so forth for the last 2 years, and he's writing about indigeneity in his prospectus for his dissertation, and something that we're interested in. And luckily, I can talk to him about some of my ideas. And so, Long is, he was born here. His parents, I think, came from Vietnam. So, yeah, he might be dropping by. We were having a little cohort lunch, but I stepped out to get my podcast on.
Yeah, well, we should explain why the long hiatus. What's it called? Well, me and Madel have both been trying to qualify. And so for those of you out there who aren't in our department or in graduate school, qualifying is basically you're done with all your classes and you know what you want to do for your dissertation. So you have to jump through a series of hoops before you can get to actually writing and researching your dissertation. So the first hoop is writing a prospectus, which is where you say, this is what I want to do. Here, let me throw you some breadcrumbs about how I would do it. Let me tell you my timeline for doing it. Let me show you what I'm reading, which will help me do it. You turn that into your committee. Then you have to take your qualifying exams, which is what was killing me and Madel over the past week, where they give you a list of questions, you pick two of them, and then you have a week to answer them in essay form. So Madel turned hers in on Monday, I turned in mine on Tuesday, and now we're gingerly anticipating the last part of our exam, which takes place next week, where we orally defend. So it's a two-hour test where they can ask you whatever they want about your project, about your essay questions, about ethnic studies, about which is the best of the Godfather films, which is the best of the Star Wars films, or, as I'm expecting, Ross.
Number two in each case, I think.
I'm expecting Ross will ask me which is the best of the Star Trek TV versions.
Oh, Next Generation.
I don't know. He'll say, Ross will say Deep Space Nine.
He will?
Yeah, because if you think about
Ross's...
That really
changes how I think about Ross. Deep Space Nine?
Well, because that's the one that's...
Cardassians. It's about colonization.
Well, it's the one about the borderlands, and it's about... If you think about his interest in, like, the American West, that's basically it. There's issues of colonization, of borders, of all sorts of stuff in Deep Space Nine. You know, The Next Generation is basically American multiculturalism...
I'm limited. Okay, I can't help it. I think Riker's sexy.
He was absolutely. I mean, I always have a thing for Data though. basically.
Yeah.
But it's more because I wish I was Data.
And then his brother, Lore.
Oh, yeah.
That was intense, man. I would feel wrung out after watching some of those episodes.
So anyways, before we get distracted too far, yeah. the exam is, you know, so now I'm preparing for the exam. I'm reading up different things so that they can, if they say in your, you know, so your essay question, you said this, you know, back it up. And so I have to read different things in order to say that, well, according to this person who's more famous than I am, or according to this person who's published books, or this person whose name you know, that's why it is. So that's why me and Madel have been out of it in another dimension, the writing dimension. And then Angie has been working on her
thesis. On my thesis. The rest of my cohort all defended theirs, and we did this funny thing where we attended each other's defenses, which isn't normally done, except for, of course, Madel. And Maguette went to Madel's last year. So, yeah, I've been supporting my cohort and working on, really, just since we went to that Indigenous Studies conference, reframing and just trying to get together my my project so that I can finish it this summer while my son is with his grandparents and his dad. I think I'm being pretty successful, but I don't feel like I'm being as creative as I was before, or even, just doing the scholarship that I'm most interested in doing the way I'm interested in doing it. But, you know, ultimately, like, this is something I have to do to get to the next stage, and in doing it, writing this project out, there's a lot of a lot of things I'm learning. Like right now, I'm reading a lot about federal Indian policy, and you know, none of that's wasted. I mean, it's all excellent and stuff I need to know. So I'm feeling really dull because I've actually been getting quite a lot of work done, especially in the past week. Long was making fun of me yesterday. He dropped by my house and asked me what I was doing, and I told him I was writing a lit review that, you know, it's just a review of the literature that I'm setting up my project as, referring to all of these books that have been written before. And he's teasing me because the lit review that I wrote for a class we took with Natalia in the fall, he said, sounded like a diary entry. And he said that he thought that Natalia was a little surprised that that's what I brought into class. And I said, well, now I'm writing a lit review with books. So it's a little different. you know, I always try to do things my way first, and it takes me longer because eventually I have to go ahead and do it I have to do what's expected of me, too. So.
Well, you might not have to later.
No, and I don't think any of what I've done is wasted, even though it feels like.
Absolutely not.
I'm 41 years old. Obviously, I'm not, you know, takes me a while. That's my pattern. So anyway, I'm hoping to be done this summer, at least at the end of the summer, by the end of September. And we'll see. So far, I'm pretty much on track. But one thing I wanted to talk about was in thinking, you know, there's the easy parts where you're just kind of going over the history of what you're talking about, the literature. But then there's thinking about, well, what's your contribution? What are your ideas? And one way that's helping me think about what I'm doing is a paper that Maguette wrote. Maguette was really generous with his qualifying answers, and he shared them with Madel and I, and so I got to read what he wrote, and I thought it was really fascinating, and I thought it was really good. I was excited to read it. I woke up early to write, and I saw that he had sent it to me. It was like 5 a.m, and I just read them right away, and it was a great way to wake up, you know, when somebody like, well, you know, it's the immediacy too. Like, he had to write these in a week, and even though whenever I ran into him again, he seemed tired and exhausted, the writing had a lot of energy, and it was really inspiring, especially his thoughts on sovereignty. Maget?
Well,
I set you up there.
Yeah, dude. No, thank you. Thank you for the setup. let me think here. Well, okay, so the questions that I got 3 questions from my exam, and the first one was the easiest, but I decided not to do it because it was actually kind of boring. It was pick a discipline, say what scholars of ethnic studies have contributed to that discipline and criticizing it and opening it up and changing it and so on. I think that's easy because we do that in our department. We have to write a paper that's exactly that. And someone actually offered me, well, if you want, you can use my paper. And I was like, I think people are going to catch on if I turn in a paper about how women's studies has been changed by ethnic studies.
That's funny.
So I decided not to go that route. The other 2 questions, which were difficult, more difficult, but I liked because they're closely linked to what I'm interested in, what I want to do as a scholar. One was basically me and Angie and Madel's podcasts and our thoughts over the past year, which was, I mean, the question was, it could have gone a number of different ways, but it was basically what have studies of indigeneity, what are their critiques of ethnic studies? And how can they be productive for ethnic studies in expanding the scope of the discipline and changing it, you know, in reframing some of its assumptions, and so on. And so our podcasts and then me and Angie and Madel's personal experiences in the department, we all kind of exist as a living answer to that question, as a constantly reshaping and changing answer to that. When we think, why are we here? It's ultimately because there is this tension between these 2 disciplines. I mean, they're not even necessarily established, fully constituted disciplines, but there is still tension between them. But at the same time, there's also a lot of overlap. Like, there's a lot of assumptions that they should be the same, they could be the same, they are the same. So that was the second question, and the one that Angie, I guess, that is closely linked to all of our projects. And then the third one was just about cultural studies and Pacific studies. And I liked answering that one, too. I mean, just what can Pacific Islander projects of decolonization kind of teach cultural studies in general? And then what can Pacific Island studies learn from cultural studies as a critical tool, methodological tool, etc. But what's called? But wait, first, before I go into this, wait, Angie, I want you to talk about how your work has changed in the past couple of weeks since like the Indigenous Studies Conference. So then I have a sense of
Okay. Well, how it's changed is that. Before I was writing, and I was looking at determination and sovereignty and this absence of my grandmother in my family, who was Cherokee, and how and why her indigeneity is lost, and when that happened, and what about that, and so. And there was this way that I was writing about it that was sort of, I can't remember the word that Ross used. I don't know, it had sort of, I guess it had a personal quality. Mm-hmm. And I would say that when I had a writing workshop with my cohort, they just said, yes, this is interesting, you should focus on one part of it. And I decided to focus on termination because I can still include, I mean, obviously I'm going to talk about sovereignty. I'm just going to include it a little less explicitly. Like, I'm looking at these congressional hearings that that are interesting, I think, historically because of when they're happening. They're happening like over 10 years after termination was voted on, 4 years after it was enacted for the Klamath tribe, and it was in 1965. And at this time, like, there were already Indian activists who were protesting with fishing rights, getting arrested. Marlon Brando had his picture taken, and in Washington, fishing illegally, and or you know, according to the treaty, it wasn't anyway. And there was also a lot of like intellectual work happening, and part of that was a response to termination, because you know how these things work. You know, you decide, oh, we're gonna take these, change this, have this federal Indian policy to assimilate, and instead, you know, these tribes organized, a lot of tribes and individuals organized to resist against that, and so in some communities got really unified, and Indian intellectualism took this leap forward, and that Robert Warrior and Paul Chet Smith talk about in like a hurricane with Clyde Warrior, and there was a conference. So I'm looking at that point of time, and then what comes up in these hearings is they're deciding whether or not to open the final rolls to allow some MODOCs to enroll before the final monies are dispersed, and I don't know, just the way that that the history of the MODOCs and the violence of the forced removal and the history after the MODOC War is engaged or not engaged with is one thing I'm looking at. And then, but what was interesting about which, and so I'm using Patchen Markell's Bound by Recognition that we read for Yenle Spiritu's class, but there's something that Maget wrote in his essay that I found like was incredibly like pointed, because you were talking about ethnic studies and how civil rights is different from the American Indian movement and the Black Panther movement, because of the way it questions the and usurps the sovereignty of the nation, and that's why it's such a threat. But in ethnic studies, these tend to get lumped together as if they're the same. And you know, I'm still gonna, I mean, I don't think I can write a paper that doesn't critique ethnic studies, you know. I don't think I can ever like not do that, but I did wake up sort of in a cold sweat this morning going, I'm writing about MODOCs, like I'm still erasing my, you know, like what about this grandmother that I need to address? And talking to Long yesterday, he was like, you know, you can still I mean, I open with talking about my family, and then he's like, you can conclude with, you know, some of that. And I think that this is just a, I mean, I think this is what it needs to be. A master's thesis is laying down the groundwork so I can do a dissertation. And what I'm learning writing this is a lot about federal Indian policy that I needed to know, a lot more about, like, the history in the 20th century that I didn't know. So I'm, you know, I'm getting the work done. But it's this isn't the fun part, you know. This is like digging the foundation and laying down the cement. Building the house will be the fun part.
Yeah, no, that's, it's good that you're realizing that, because I think a lot of students get overwhelmed with what the thesis is supposed to be, and so they think that that's it. But then, yeah, it just keeps building. I mean, my lit review, although I don't know if I should say this, but my lit review for my my prospectus, my dissertation, is basically the work that I've done before. I mean, because it's all built. I have a series of questions, and then all the questions have built on top of each other, and that's the way it should work. I mean, where one project ends, you know, it should lead into your next one. So yeah, it would be, you know, you could always bring that in at the end of your project.
As, yeah, I feel like this is, it's just really going to... take me to where I can do my what I want to do, and I'll be this a better scholar then too.
But no, this, I mean, I like both of your projects. I like the one you read it in at the Indigenous Studies one, just because of the way it was written, and then, I mean, it's kind of, It is personal, but then it's the point where the personal is, you know, can actually be more political. So that's what I liked about it, was that there was a way of making all the events that you're describing and all the policies and all the things you're describing, making it kind of more present, precisely because it's kind of ghostly in the text. Like, you're not saying, you're not doing it like a social science reading, you know, you're not throwing it in there, an appropriate paragraph to attend to this, and then cite appropriate scholar, and then do appropriate two-line gist of what book is.
That's a lot more what it looks like now.
Okay, well, that's fine, too.
I know. Well, you know what, though? I can't... It opens with two pages, though, of me talking about, like, what it meant to me to, find out, like, you know, when you have those conversations about, like, being Indian, mm-hmm. you know? Because you have to have them because at school and because at home. And mm-hmm. and then, well, what tribe are we? Mm-hmm. But we're terminated. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. Like, so you belong to a tribe that doesn't exist, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I mean, and nobody's going to know, you know, what it is. My mom's like, well, you're Modoc, but, you know, everyone's going to think you're saying Mohawk. So just say Klamath. And, you know, like, you know, so And I guess that I always do try to embody it, like, that these aren't, these are people, and that the people are members of my family, and people whose histories haven't been written, that, you know, they're not the, what does Hegel call them? The world, you know? Oh, I can't believe I just referenced Hegel, but, you know, the world historical, whatever, you know, this is just, we're just these people, you know, I'm just trying to find out what happened, you know, I mean, I think my family's really interesting, and for a lot of reasons, like, there's, been a lot of silence in my family around our, indigeneity, and part of that has to do with, termination and, shame around that, you know, yeah, so,
No, yeah, don't worry, don't feel guilty or
I know.
Remorse for going in the more social science-y direction. It's, you can always do that, you can always do that, that project later, it won't, it's not as if you go in this direction, you can never change to the other one or do anything else. I mean, that's part of the reason that I think that academia becomes so rigid, is because of the assumptions of how we grow. And that you move in this direction, there's no chance for you to ever pick up that more literary pen again, or that more poetic pen again, because you've put on the shackles of that unwieldy, bulky, ugly, social science-y pen.
I mixed metaphors fear there, sorry. I'm not finishing, you know? I feel like I'm just switching ponies, you know?
No, yeah, just get it done and get out of here.
Yeah.
That's what one of my committee members says. He's like, we get it's good that you want to do lots of things and say lots of things, but get it done and get out of here.
So, we have other things to do.
Yeah, definitely.
I miss my family.
No. I miss my family too. Mm. But that's why we form new families. Me and Madel and Angie, we are a family here.
Yeah, they're the Wonder Twins.
Well, so I mean, I'm glad that my answers were helpful to Angie. I mean, I can't take credit for it, because those things evolved basically through our discussions over the past year. And then our discussions, the podcasts, working with Ross Frank on the Indigenous Studies / Native American Studies cluster hire, taking that directed reading with you guys school year, just a whole number of things. I mean, I realized that what I've come to realize is that a lot of times, that question was really hard to approach. The one about what are the critiques of indigeneity, of ethnic studies, or what critiques do indigeneity make of ethnic studies? Because, well, it's one of those things which is so easy, it's hard. Because, like I wrote in my essay, like, me and Angie and Madel, we critique ethnic studies all the time. it's no big deal. Like, oh, everybody knows what's wrong. We go to the Indigenous Studies Conference and people are like, yeah, ethnic studies. Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's great. At least it's brown and black people. But we know the problems there. When I was doing research on answering that question, it was so easy that it was actually a pain because no one was really writing about the problems. That's what made it so difficult. And then the one really good article that I did find about it, I found really late, so I actually didn't incorporate it except as a footnote. But I didn't really need to because it was just kind of this caricature of ethnic studies. And then a review of that article responded by basically caricaturing Indigenous studies. Both of them just basically said, one said, well, the experiences of Native Americans are different than people in ethnic studies. And the critical review of that article said basically, no, they're the same. I mean, they say it's colonialism, but colonialism is basically the experiences of minorities and other ethnic groups in the United States. They're making a distinction that doesn't exist. And so, I mean, that's the problem. That's what I felt my first year when I came into ethnic studies, is that I would try and just articulate kind of the experiences of coming from Guam. And I would say that, you know, that this is not necessarily ethnic studies. I don't understand it as that. This is, you know, this is Indigenous stuff or whatever. And people would be like, that's essentialist, you know, because you're not joining the people of color world. Or why are you saying it's different? I mean, would I experience racism just like you experience racism. Why is it different? And why would what's the point of saying it's different if we're all not white? So we can critique those things, those problems, because it's obvious that those responses, I mean, it boggles my mind when people make those responses and they don't immediately stop and say, oh, I'm sorry, that's the dumbest thing I've ever said. But they don't, because it's just this kind of this naturalized thing, because people don't actually go to, not the differences of culture, like, oh, Native Americans are tied to the earth, you know, or Indigenous people are tied to land, and Indigenous people believe in gods and spirits, and then minority people don't, or ethnic studies people don't. You can make those claims, and a lot of times I would make those claims, but not in ethnic studies, not in academia. I believe that those sorts of discussions belong elsewhere. If you're going to be in kind of critical academia, then you can't go in that direction. You can't say that basically, well, we're different. We're just different. Because then what happens is, well, we should be apart. We shouldn't be together. I mean, why would you do Indigenous studies and ethnic studies if you're completely different? You would just suffer. But so what I decided to do for my question was kind of stay away from a lot of the cultural, epistemological, aesthetic arguments, and then kind of focus on, what does ethnic studies say it does other than talk about ethnic people? And why is that problematic from the perspective of the existence of Indigenous people in the United States? And then if we take the position of Indigenous people in the United States and not subsume it into a people of color matrix, what can we learn about processes of racialization that we wouldn't get otherwise by simply subsuming them all together? So, and I lost my train of thought there. So for me, a lot of it was just ethnic studies critiques the nation. I mean, when it begins in the 1960s, you have people from all different minority groups, you have Native Americans as well, making critiques of the whiteness of the U.S. nation, basically, and then also at the same time making transnational critiques with anti-imperialist activism, third world, you know, liberation movements, and so on. So you have all of this stuff going on, but ultimately, with the exception of, let's say, the Black Panther movement and the American Indian movement, of all these big movements, everybody is not critiquing the nation state, they're critiquing the nation. So when they say that we want our voices heard in the academy, we want our literature, we have culture, they're not critiquing the nation state, they're critiquing the nation. They're saying that the nation is white, or the nation is not really white. You know, there are all of us who have existences, who deserve to be recognized, who deserve to have our cultures understood, our cultures shared, our histories read, our literatures read, our songs sung. So, what's it called? So that's one of the problems with it. It's not necessarily that Indigenous people have this cultural difference or this experience difference, which isn't tied to kind of fundamental, or what's it called? Wait, let me start all over. But it's that, in relation to the state, to the nation state, they have a difference, as you see, basically, if you look at the law, right? I mean, what Angie's talking about, you know, there is a subcommittee, there's no longer a committee, now there's a subcommittee, right?
Mm-hmm.
For Native Americans. Native Americans aren't administered through congressional representatives. They are administered through the Department of Interior, the Bureau of American, you know, of Bureau of Indian Affairs, or.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like there is this different relationship, and to simply say that they're not white won't kind of capture that. It won't get at their experiences as having that difference. You can say that they both experience racism, but what that difference of experience is isn't simply varying degrees of racism or oppression. It's basically different relationships to the nation state.
Mm-hmm.
And so by not subsuming them and throwing them together, what you have is you can develop a more nuanced critique, not the U.S. nation, although you can do that too, but of the U.S. nation state. Because what's it called? One of the things that I noted was that ethnic studies is becoming more transnational. And that's, you know, that's exciting and that's good because, yeah, you know, it's good because it shows U.S. I mean, I don't even have to say these things because you can just read anywhere kind of the lauding of this. Because, you know, it shows the machinations, the interventions, the neocolonialism, the imperialism of the U.S. nation, bringing people here, kind of messing with other places. And then it also at the same time shows how the nation is not bounded by territory. The nation stretches through imagined communities across oceans, across countries, and so on. But my critique of this transnational gesture was that in order to critique the U.S. nation, or possibly the U.S. nation state, you connect it to other nations. But there is no cognizance. There is no using of the great body of American Indian literature out there, which talks about the nations within the U.S. nation state. Their histories, their political struggles, their continued existence up to today. It's not that these are like fading echoes. You know, these are not things which, if you don't look at them for a couple of years, they stop being there. They're still there. They still exist. And so you have articulations of the U.S. nation state in a transnational framework as a state-to-state framework. But, so the U.S. and Japan, the U.S. and the Philippines, the U.S. and India, the U.S. and South Africa, the U.S. and Mexico, whatever. But so you connect these two nations to each other, and basically you, by doing that, you accept the stupidest political science assumptions about what constitutes states.
Mm.
And that's that sovereign, you know, or nation states, is that they have a state, one state per territory, no more than that. So basically you continue the project of making sure that the native exists.
Yes.
Or not exists, the native disappears, sorry. You continue the project of ensuring that the native continues to disappear by first accepting modern assumptions, the most base modern assumptions about political science, about nation states, but then at the same time by accepting the legitimacy of the U.S. nation state as a settler colonial nation state. For what I'm saying, that's the shorthand. That's the shorthand kind of version of it, is that ethnic studies is not critiquing the U.S. nation state as a settler colonial state in the present. What you can find sometimes is when you have histories of U.S. imperialism, they'll discuss the genocide of Native Americans in history, but connect that and then export it elsewhere. So that violence then becomes exported from this continent to other places, like the Philippines or Vietnam or the Middle East. But then once you take that, once you jam it into that transnational framework, you basically, it's the fact that that violence, you know, is embodied in the nations within nations today, you know, you lose the fact that they continually contest the sovereignty of the U.S. nation state by continuing to exist, and that you continue the project of their colonization and their disappearance and their silencing by not bringing that into today in your articulation of the U.S. nation state. So,
Maget claimed that every articulation of the nation and nation state within ethnic studies needs to reference indigeneity and indigenous nations. And I thought that was great. I have a question, though, because to me, and I heard this at the conference, and Madel and I kind of got into it a little bit when she referenced herself as a settler. Mm-hmm. And I said, wait a second. You know, like, how does your presence here, like, I mean, this might just be my indoctrination into ethnic studies, but I do see that, you know, U.S. militarism and colonialism has, you know, produced, like, people who mm-hmm. are not indigenous to this nation living here. Mm-hmm. And I don't see them, though, as settlers the same way that, say, Hanani K. Trask sees the, you know, Asian settlers in Hawaii. Mm. Is that just semantics? Because to me, some problem I have with indigenous studies is that I love your critique because I think it unsettles mm-hmm. and disrupts, and I think that that's like, I think you're meeting your committee where they're at, and I love that. I think, though, that we can go a little further than what I consider name-calling.
Mm-hmm.
To a place, a beautiful place, to a land where the river runs free. See, I might just be too indoctrinated by ethnic studies and by this. I might be multicultural, dude. I want indigenous studies, and I want the work in ethnic studies to go beyond this. Okay, so then there's the recognition of indigeneity. Uh-huh. Okay, good. Great. We get that. Uh-huh. And then we get this settler thing. Okay, everyone. But then there has to be this other place, though, where we go, these people who are here because of U.S. imperialism and militarism are our brothers. And instead of them in the Ethnic Studies Project whining and complaining about how they don't get to be white like white people and how they don't get home loans and they don't get their piece of the American apple pie, how do we get them in on the revolution? Mm. Oh, my God. I turn into Jose. Oh, shit.
It makes sense, but it's difficult, right? Because so many, like,
nobody's going home, dude.
No, but then, okay, let me think here.
I guess maybe we're not going to solve it here.
No, we won't. And whatever. And the thing is that no matter what we say, it doesn't necessarily mean it will have an impact on anything. So, like, we could say that this is what needs to be done, but that doesn't mean that anyone will actually do their scholarship differently.
You know what? I completely disagree with you.
I hope.
Every time you and I, like, open our mouths and gesture and write things down, I see... It's like the lay the freaking heaven up in here.
It could, no.
I think it can, will, and do. In fact, I expect to see what Maget said around 32 to 34 minutes into this podcast in a lot of papers that I read that are published and at conferences. I expect that a lot of the things that you have said in our podcasts are going to be premises for the intellectual work in indigenous studies. Am I crazy? That's what I think is going to happen. I sit here when he's talking and I take notes, you know, and cite him too, you guys. But seriously, like, I find that I think that we're that this is the work.
Mm-hmm.
So no, nothing's wasted. That's what
I think. I know, but then I don't know, because the problem is that if you, that's the, because kind of the problem, the reason that this isn't in ethnic studies already is because of that multicultural assumption. That nobody's going home. I mean, that's kind of, the problem is that even the person of color in the United States is kind of, the national subject is very much entangled in kind of a bourgeoisie consciousness, which is basically like, oh yeah, I know you have been wronged, I know you need justice, but I cannot lose anything in that process.
Exactly.
And so, I mean, that's why, like, in Australia, every time there's something comes up for Aborigines, like, there's a courting case where they could possibly get some small dose of sovereignty, some sort of rights to land, like, all people have to do is say, if this case goes their way, you will lose your land, you will lose your property, and then the public is, we can't do this, these people are backwards, they're primitive, they don't deserve anything, they're lazy, they're pathological, etc.
Well, talk to me about Guam.
Well, and so, no, I admit that, maybe no one is going home. That's not the...
Maybe. It's okay.
Well, no.
We're not discounting the possibility. Anything could happen. TB.
That's true, it's true. But I mean, it's not the... It's really, I don't think it's really the... It's really our task here to basically come up with something that suits that need.
No, I don't think so either.
I think that for what we need to do is basically, you know, like you said, disrupt people.
Yeah.
Because break that consciousness that says that, you know what, I have worked so hard for everything.
Yeah.
I cannot give you anything. Or I cannot let go of anything.
Yeah. That's definitely the ethnic studies thing. It's true.
And so but you have to break that, because once people can break that assumption, that's when the U.S. state starts getting delegitimized on a daily basis. When people start realizing that,
right,
those things. And so, I mean, I'm not, you know, this is not saying that, although it would be fantastic. It would be fantastic if suddenly all Native American tribes had sovereign power over their territory. Yeah, there'll be problems, but I would love it nonetheless. I mean, but there have been a lot of people that are writing on what Native Americans would do if they became sovereign. So if they became decolonized.
I love that, possibilities. I have a part of my thesis that's about possibilities.
Mm-hmm. And then this is one of the differences, is that if, and then this is when I will start to go into making epistemological and cultural claims about indigenous people. But I think it's Madonna Thunderhawk, I think she has a good piece where she writes about that, and it's just like, I mean, it's the difference between indigenous subjects and then, let's say, a modern white subject. Because if you look at the history of treatment of indigenous people, and then, I wonder if I'll get in trouble for this, but if you look at then the history of mistreatment of Jews and then Israel, like, there is this discourse of Jews as being, we have suffered the most, therefore we will never let that happen again to anyone else. But then what is their state but kind of one of the most violent settler colonial states? Naturalized, not even contested, although it should be contested a lot more, you know. And so, you know, they have this way of saying, oh, well, you know, we have suffered so much and we will, no one ever should ever suffer like that again. But then the constant violence and the occupation of Palestine, the building of walls and stuff, it's just like they have not learned that lesson. They may say that lesson, but it's a cover, basically, to produce their exceptionality so that they, of all people, should be allowed to enact this violence. But then what you have, I know I read it with Madonna Thunderhawk, she talks about how, like, indigenous, you know, if Native Americans did get sovereignty, you know, that would not be their project. Because, you know, this is one of the pushes, is against modernity, against modernity's assumptions. And I don't think we should just always assume that everything is modern. Because once you do that, then you take away possibility.
Mm-hmm.
You take away sovereignty, because that's the assumption, is that if the Native Americans become sovereign, they'll be just like every other screwed up person in the history of the world who kills people, gets rid of people, colonizes people, and so on. And so that trap, that modern trap, I mean, it has to be resisted, because that's the fears. That's one of the fears, that modernity will just produce people who continue to be screwed up. So,
I don't know. It's Fanon, right, too?
No. Well, Fanon is a humanist. Fanon says that Africa, that the colonized world can do different. It can. He's not modern, but basically that the violence and decolonization can provide the break with that cycle.
I think we had a great podcast today.
Yeah, well, sorry, I talked so much.
It was great. It was a lot of fun for me. I mean, I enjoyed it, so I hope you all did, too.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I guess we're going to go look for Long right now and see if he's around.
Well, first we should sing something, though.
Oh, yeah, what should we sing?
Why are there so many songs about rainbows? And what's on the other side?
That's all that I know.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, thank you for listening. Okay, we're back.
Thanks a lot.